Hey, thanks, Judith, for that. And I want to share my screen if that's okay. So do the PowerPoint. Can you guys see that? Whoever.
Yes.
Can see? Okay, fantastic. First of all, thank you for that very, very warm introduction. A few corrections, however. I've actually been an attorney for almost 30 years at this point, and I took over the office almost 5 years ago. So those are the big two corrections. And I actually started my career in the Chicago Public Defender's Office. It's an honor being here to speak with you today. And please apologize, I'm a trial lawyer by nature. So sitting and talking and doing this type of presentation is counterintuitive to what my skill set is, which is public speaking in a forum where I can move and talk. So I apologize. But this is a really important topic. And I want to open up by posing a few simple questions. First, why are we even still talking about systemic racism in 2021? Why are Black and brown men and women still dying at the hands of law enforcement? Why are Black and brown men and women overrepresented in the criminal justice system? And most importantly, what can you do about it? Now, I have to tell you, in preparing for this talk, one of the things I did is Judith was kind enough to share with me the links to the previous speaker's audio recordings, and what a wonderful series. And I have to tell you, I must admit that I am very humbled and intimidated to follow with these talks, because I would describe them as sort of like the mic drop presentations. They were amazing. Their personal stories, insights, and the information they shared were powerful and thought-provoking, and also make for a fantastic platform for my talk today, which is entitled Confronting Systemic Racism in the Criminal Justice System. I also reread Jesus and the Disinherited, the book I first read as required reading while attending Loyola University of Chicago many, many years ago. I suspect many of you know that Jesuit institutions such as Loyola are known for their educational discipline and academic excellence. St. Ignatius wrote that the more universal a good, the more divine it is, which he applied to education in, frankly, an inspired way to build community and share God's word. It was his vision that education was not just about the value of universal knowledge, but by integrating faith and learning that it would give greater glory to God. Unfortunately, and I'm sure you know this too, institutional and systemic racism is also part of the Jesuit history. Pursuing the more universal good led to the subjugation and destruction of indigenous populations and their cultures. It also cannot be ignored that Jesuit schools, like I had the privilege of attending, were and remain, for the most part, predominantly white and elite institutions. Now you may be asking, well, she's talking about criminal justice. Why is she talking about St. Ignatius? Why she's talking about indigenous populations and her education? I think it's a good reference point to start this dialogue. This is a good reference point to start the dialogue that is long overdue, the long overdue awakening and reckoning on systemic racism that stretches over generations, across multiple institutions, and into the smallest reaches of our daily existence, not just the criminal justice system. The awakening, the reckoning, and the long overdue change that has been so elusive starts with each of you, your families, the collective us, our communities, our churches, our local leaders, and our local institutions. To address systemic racism, especially in the criminal justice system, requires a call to action, which will be the centerpiece of this talk and my message to you. Make no mistake, poverty, poor educational opportunities, lack of access to healthcare, to name a few, are all an integral part of the system that feeds the criminal justice system. And for the Black and brown community, it's also rooted in decades of discriminatory practices and policies. A simple fact is this: our current jail population in Santa Barbara County is estimated, 60% of that population is estimated to be experiencing mental health issues or suffering from substance abuse. Most have experienced trauma. Now think about this for a moment. We are incarcerating folks who hit the wrong type of lottery, a trifecta of things that have little or no control over in their personal lives: the trauma they experienced, the mental illness they inherited, or the circumstances in their life, such as being beaten or traumatized by their family members. It's important to emphasize that individuals who make up our jail population are our neighbors. They're our children. They're members of our own family. They're not the other, spoken about as defendants and dehumanized by a system that wants to process them rather than understand the barriers and circumstances that contribute to their involvement in the criminal justice system. To address systemic racism in the criminal justice system calls for us to reimagine the criminal justice system and ultimately demand from our elected officials on every level to take action, to be accountable to the community they serve, and replace words with meaningful change. To address systemic racism, each of you need to be accountable. So let's start out with race matters in our criminal justice system. Besides it being more than two times likely that you'll be killed by a police officer if you're Black or Brown, it affects how likely you are to be pulled over by the police, how likely you are to be released or detained, how likely the state is to seek the death penalty, and how harshly you are going to be punished. Systemic racism led to mass incarceration. Systemic racism has destroyed entire communities of color. Systemic racism has separated and broken apart families of color. Systemic racism has led to the senseless murders of men and women of color like George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Now you may be wondering why I chose my virtual background and what it means. And I just want to take a moment and I want you to look at those beautiful faces behind me. Those are all the faces of Black and Brown women killed by law enforcement, most of them unarmed. The video that played on national news over and over again, and the photo you now see on this slide sparked worldwide outrage. I was outraged, and I also felt an exhaustion and sadness. An exhaustion and sadness because for my whole life, I've been front and center and witness to daily injustices, not only that I personally witnessed in my childhood, but throughout my life and career. This is why I opened with the question, why are we still talking about these things in 2021? Now, I started my legal career in 1992, the same year that Rodney King was viciously beaten by police officers. We all watched the streets erupt when an all-white jury acquitted each and every white officer who swung a baton or stood by and watched. But as I said, I grew up on the south side of Chicago. Now, these photos that I'm sharing with you right now are personal photos. I grew up in a community named Bridgeport. Bridgeport was the mayor's neighborhood. It's home of the White Sox and the center of political power in Chicago. It's also notorious for racial hostility. My family faithfully worshiped in one of the oldest Catholic churches on the Chicago South Side, St. Bridget's, built in 1913. And everyone in my family had been baptized, married, buried in that church until it sadly and unfortunately was torn down many, many, many years later. And this angelic photo, although if my parents were alive, they would tell you the angelic photo of me here doesn't reflect the quote unquote hell I gave them as a child. But that photo is of me receiving my first communion. I'm the young one in the first row, fourth one in. So this photo of me receiving my first communion in that beautiful old church hides the deeper truth about my neighborhood and the world I was witnessing around me. In my neighborhood, in Bridgeport, if a Black person crossed under the wrong bridge or turned into the wrong street, it led to a guaranteed beatdown and often death. My childhood memories, represented by this archived photo of a protest in my neighborhood that was taken in 1966, was taken around the same time as my first communion. Now you may all be thinking, well, Trace, come on, this is the 60s, everything has changed since then. In part, that would be absolutely true, but much hasn't changed. I wanna fast forward to 2020. As George Floyd was murdered and the protest started, including in this area in the greater area of Chicago, This photo was taken in my neighborhood. It's not of white people joining arm in arm with protesters who filled the streets in sorrow and grief and anger over George's murder. They showed up armed with bats to protect the neighborhood from the Black Lives Matter protesters. A year later, very recently, our Capitol was stormed. And on the same day, the first Black senator who was elected to the Senate from Georgia, the Confederate flag, a symbol of white power and hate, was paraded through our most sacred government institution. To dismantle systemic racism in any of our systems, but especially in our criminal justice system, requires first and foremost, and your other speakers have talked about this, acknowledging and accepting, not denying that it exists, and that each of us play a role. The knee that suffocated George Floyd for a heart-wrenching 8 minutes and 37 seconds unfolded while three other officers watched and did nothing. It was also not the first knee that Derek Chauvin placed on a person of color's neck. And again, this is why I open with the questions of why are we still talking about this in 2021? Why haven't we been able to fix this? Why is this still happening? But I'll tell you, it didn't take long after George Floyd's murder. It didn't take long at all to hear what we've always heard, that what happened that day was an example of just a bad apple. And these bad apples are giving law enforcement a bad name. To root out racism, we need to fix the barrel, not just throw out the apple. And part of fixing the barrel is re-examining our criminal justice system as a whole. And so I want to talk about what systemic racism really is. Systemic racism is not the same as saying that everyone in the system is racist. I mean, we sort of get stuck in this debate, right? This is what happens. Unfortunately, death after death occurs, mass incarceration cascades, our jails fill up, and we talk about racial disparities. But we get stuck in this debate of either the system is fundamentally racist and everybody, police officers and everybody involved in the system is bad, or nobody's racist and nothing's bad and everything's good. That's the debate we've been stuck in for decades. Systemic racism means that we have institutions that produce racially disparate outcomes, negative outcomes. Some people do worse than others depending on what system you're in. And here's a great example. We're in the midst of a pandemic. And it's very relevant and timely to talk about systemic racism in this category. People of color have been disproportionately impacted by the deadly virus, the same way that people of color have been disproportionately impacted negatively by the criminal justice system. And we know why. Lack of access to healthcare, poverty, and the justified suspicion of systems that have treated these communities poorly. I included in this presentation, as Judith mentioned, a lot of data, our county data and national data. I'm not going to tease out all the data for you or spend time looking at the trends. But let me share one data point with you, which should cause each of you significant pause, especially when each of us fundamentally as parents, grandparents, brothers, and sisters know this simple truth that our children are our most precious gift and resource. I want you to look at this slide and I want you to digest the statistics here. This is recent data from California. In 2019, there was an examination of our juvenile system. For those of you who are not familiar with what happens with juveniles in our criminal justice system, many youth unfortunately get involved in some mischief, criminal behavior at times, some worse than others. The criminal justice system takes them and absorbs them, and it's become known as the school to prison pipeline. Now think about this. Think about what's happening to Black children and brown children versus a white child who gets in the same trouble. And statistically, it's supported. You're 5.1 times more likely to be referred to probation. That means someone other than your parent is going to be watching over you, supervising you. 7.7 times more likely to have a petition filed in juvenile court. That means instead of a slap on the hand, which happens often in a law enforcement setting with a white child being taken back home, a Black or brown child is actually taken into the criminal justice system. 9.5 times more likely to be declared a ward of the court. That means your life as a child is taken over by the court system and by probation. 31.3 times more likely to be committed to DJJ. And for those of you who do not know what DJJ is, that's juvenile prison. 31.3 times. And when you look at these statistics, it's not just based on brown and black and white statistics. It is for the same crimes, for the same events, the same mischief. And it's the same thing for our brown, Latin and Latinx. And this is actually where you come in. You know, racial disparities in our criminal justice system is simply not an accident. It's just not accidental. It didn't just happen. These disparities are rooted in the history of oppression and discriminatory decision-making that have deliberately targeted these communities. Now, I did send, and I do, and I hope everybody watched Brian Stevenson's TED Talk. It's short, it's powerful. He's amazing. He's a leader talking about the issues that have been so important and a leader in dismantling the death penalty against juveniles in our country. Also, the article in The Atlantic summarizes what I believe is a must-watch documentary called The 13th. I mean, systemic racism is such a big topic, too big for me, too big for a single conversation. It covers hundreds of years of history and policy decisions that have led us to this day. And The 13th is a documentary on Netflix, if you have Netflix, that's worthy of watching because it puts a nice, I want to say, sort of summary and a bow on this subject that's very digestible, but so very important. So one thing I'm talking about today is if you really want to be part of the solution, you have to be educated and informed. It's a critical first step. Otherwise, the tough on crime, law and order, war on drug narratives, and rhetoric, which will continue to drive mass incarceration, disparate outcomes, and the continued dehumanization of the justice involved. So I want to offer you a simple premise, and it's an important one, that every funding decision by our county and state leaders is a policy decision. When we spend $120 million to build a new jail and $20+ million to remodel an old jail, as opposed to investing a percentage of that money into our community to build affordable housing, job training, to support rehabilitation, or other alternatives to incarceration, and to meaningfully address the root causes of disparity and inequality in our community, this is plain and simple funding decisions that amount to policy decisions that values incarceration over all else. Now, before you go down the road of saying, oh my God, here she goes, she's gonna tell us we defund the police. That's not what I believe in. That's not what I'm saying. It's not what I'm advocating. But consider this. This chart that I put up is what we spend as a county cumulatively. So round up, approximately $400 million to arrest, incarcerate, prosecute, defend, and supervise individuals accused of crimes. And you need to factor this in, that the vast majority of crimes charged in Santa Barbara County are overwhelmingly misdemeanor crimes. And many of these individuals are cycling through the system. Now, again, $400 million to arrest, incarcerate, prosecute, defend, and supervise individuals accused of crime. Many of that population are people of color, Black and brown. $400 million. Nationally, we spend close to $260 billion a year to incarcerate individuals. And again, digest this slide. The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, yet we have 25% of the prisoners worldwide, 25%. Again, the vast majority, the highest percentage are people of color. And it doesn't make us safer. It doesn't make us safer. Now, as a trial lawyer, I've learned even the best audiences like yourselves have a very limited attention span. So my goal today was to be provocative and spark debate and discussion. And, you know, and I want to challenge you to demand more of our leaders. And that simply telling us that they're not racist or they don't support racist policies is not enough. And I am going to talk about our county very specifically right now. When George Floyd's murder happened, our community rose up. We were also collectively exhausted and tired. We were collectively angry. And public safety, that's the group I'm in, from, you know, it's probation, district attorney's office, public defender's office, the sheriff, law enforcement, the courts, all of us entered into this dialogue. And the community was so upset with the debate. They were upset with the debate because a lot of folks in public safety did exactly what we all were tired of hearing, which is defending everybody else and not acknowledging that there really is a problem. It was us talking about, well, I'm not racist, therefore nothing's racist, the sort of that tired cycle that we've gotten into. So I'm going to ask you and I'm going to challenge you to demand more of your leaders. I'm going to challenge you and demand that you demand more of your leaders when we're examining funding decisions so we can support building healthy, strong communities and don't overly invest in systems that don't make us safer. Now, right now, as we speak, we're in budget season in this county. Right now, as we speak, our board and our CEO's office are deciding how to spend our budget, how we're going to invest in our community, what departments to support. And I challenge you that as we go down this and we want to address these kind of issues, that we should demand our funding to be placed where it means the most in our community, where it means the most to change the narrative that many of our brown and black community members are experiencing. I challenge you to escape the rhetoric and narratives we've been told for generations, the Willie Horton arguments. You know, I mean, we've been talking about these things and using narrative and rhetoric that help create mass incarceration, over policing, and soul crushing over supervision. Right now, we're in this shift to de-incarcerate, but what's ultimately happening in many of our brown and black brothers and sisters are going to tell you this is maybe we're moving away from it over incarceration, but we're moving in a direction where they're over supervised, that you have young men and women wearing GPS monitors, young men and women reporting to probation and parole and being supervised in the community, in effect imprisoned in their own communities and no more free. Most of all, I urge you to continue to do what you're now doing, just learning, and most importantly, listening. Although my voice may be important because of my position in the county, but the most important voice is our Black and Brown community members who do not feel heard. They don't feel heard. You also need to demand data. You need to demand the data from law enforcement. Are there arresting practices resulting in disparate treatment of Brown and Black? The report I shared with you suggests it does. And I encourage you to read that report. From our DA, is her charging policies resulting in disparate treatment of our Brown and Black brothers and sisters who are involved in the criminal justice system? From probation, from public health, all of the agencies that we fund, they should be reporting to the community the impact of their policies and procedures that are impacting this community. And although I do not support defunding the police, I do believe we need to invest in what makes our community safer. Now, here's another data point I want to share with you as we start to wrap up this discussion. Now, again, I want to rewind and remember we spent $400 million in our county alone to prosecute, arrest, incarcerate, defend people who are charged with crimes. $260 billion nationally. We have 25% of the world population in prison. And this is the data, the overwhelming numbers. And I'll share this PowerPoint with Judith if you want to get behind some of these data or to be able to use it as a discussion point, as long as you promise you don't share my first communion picture on social media. Every 3 seconds, police in the United States arrest someone Every 3 seconds. That's 10.5 million people arrested every year, the vast majority, like our county, for low-level nonviolent offenses. The vast majority of cases my department has represented in this county are misdemeanors. We represent about 2,300 felonies per year. Now, that may sound like a large number, but it is absolutely not. The vast majority, 10,000 plus cases, are all misdemeanors. Again, $400 million to prosecute, arrest, incarcerate, and supervise. Only 5% of the arrests are for violent crimes. Again, our world is much safer. Our community is much safer than the news lets on. Our community is much safer than law enforcement lets on. And Black people make up 12% of the US population total, but 28% of all arrests. 240 million calls are made to 911 each year. Only 1% are for violent crimes. When I challenge you to help change the narrative by being educated and informed, know the data, and demand that our leaders talk honestly and transparently about these issues. This is one of my favorite quotes. Until the land of the free is free of racism, until the home of the brave is brave enough to change, until by the people and for the people means doing right by all the people, until justice just is. That's my hope and my dream for me, having done this for 30 years, to see change, to see meaningful change. And yeah, I agree, my childhood in 1966 and the kind of protests and things and the ugliness that I saw, the blatant racism, we've gone a couple steps away from that, but we're still in a lot of hurt and there still needs to be a lot of change. And Bryan Stevenson says his best, and this is the last challenge. He says, always do the right thing, even when the right thing is the hard thing. What we need to do as a community, what we need to do individually is a hard thing. It's what your previous speakers talked about, which is looking inside, examining ourselves, our own unconscious biases, our own perceptions. If we care about this issue, we need to be engaged. We need to demand. We need to be educated. We need to be informed. We need to challenge the people that are in power to make the changes that we need. And we need to listen to the community that we care about. So I'm challenging you to do the hard thing right now. And the hard thing is never, never easy. And I want to end with this very powerful photo of the memorial that was set up for George Floyd, all the flowers and his beautiful picture. And I want you to also remember the George Floyd and the many others that have died at the hand of law enforcement were human beings. And maybe they were complicated human beings, but they were human beings whose life and dignity deserve respect. And so thank you so much for allowing me to speak. Thank you so much for being willing to listen to me. And I'm happy to take any and all questions. I do have my contact information, my email, and my mobile phone. I love talking to community members. I would strongly encourage you to be engaged in what's going to be going on over the next couple of months, our board hearings. The board needs to hear from people like you about your concerns, your interest, and what you want them to do. So thank you very, very much.